Has anyone here ever felt morally superior over someone else because you or maybe I hadn't engaged in a morally questionable behavior that this other person was engaged in? Maybe some of us have even brought up the point, perhaps in a roundabout way, that we should be looked upon as more upright and better people because we aren't engaging in those kinds of behaviors. Maybe we don't bring it up publicly, but maybe we think it inside our minds. Maybe the issue isn't even one of the so-called morally offensive things, but a small thing, say, someone else's vocabulary versus ours, or how someone else dresses in ways that we certainly wouldn't approve, or in any of the other multitude of areas where our behaviors, values, and standards are different from someone else's. But you and I might object, what if the issue is clearly about a sin? Don't we have the obligation to point it out? Was there ever a time in the life of Jesus where he dealt with such an issue? And so this brings us to the next passage in our journey through the Gospel according to John. John chapter 7, the last verse, verse 53, and on into chapter 8 through verse 11. This is the incident of the woman caught in adultery. The very act, some translations add. But before we get into the text, we should get to know some of the background of this passage. First of all, it's almost 100% certain that John did not write this passage. In fact, no one really knows how it came to be added to this book. The best guess is that it was an oral tradition for many centuries, and that it began to be written down and placed in different places. You know, sometimes it appears in Luke, sometimes it appears in different parts of John. Sometimes it appears just by itself in other manuscripts. But it appears that it was most commonly placed in this section of John. The vocabulary and style of the Greek is very unlike the rest of John's writings. So a question that might be raised is then why is it in the Bible? Now, there were many writings we know about whose authorship was more certain that were left out. Now, the New Testament canon, the collection of 27 books that make up the New Testament, was pretty much complete by the 3rd century. This passage that we're looking at this morning was not added to John. It did not become a permanent fixture of this gospel until perhaps the 5th century. Well, so, in fact, when better manuscripts became available to translators, some of them originally omitted this passage entirely from the Bible because it was not present. Today, nearly all of our translations do include these verses, but most have a footnote explaining this fact, and some places have these verses in parentheses. So why is it in the Bible? Now, there are verses in the Bible that are only in footnotes now or not present at all, that may have been present in back in the 17th century, the King James Version. So why is this passage still here? It's here because the passage, although not written by John, is believed to be an authentic account of an incident in Jesus' life. And because the actions of Jesus do not contradict the character of God that is revealed in the rest of Scripture. This passage is placed in such a way as to, it seems like it happened on the night after the last day of the Feast of Shelters. And then the next morning, this incident happens. Well, we really don't know when it happened either. What it does fit in, though, into this section, because it fits into the theme of judgment that's present in chapter 7, as well as chapter 8. This encounter also fits kind of the theme of darkness and light that will be coming in the next verses of chapter 8. And chapter 8 ends with the people trying to stone Jesus. The theme of kind of the idea of stoning the woman in this passage. Now, getting on the topic of stoning, I don't know what comes to mind when you think of people stoning someone to death. And what I'm about to describe is kind of gruesome, really. But I think it's important to understand because it explains some other things further down. We probably see a mental picture of the accused in the middle with a bunch of people standing around throwing stones at them. Sometimes, because of rage, such as, I'll say, Stephen in the book of Acts, this is what happened. But the correct stoning procedure for adultery, as prescribed by the rabbis, was for the accused, both the woman and the man, to have their hands tied behind them, stripped half naked, set upon a scaffold some 10 to 12 feet up, and then one of the witnesses would push the accused to the ground so that it would fall face forward onto the ground, basically crushing their chests. And if the accused were killed from the force of the impact, that was it. Otherwise, one of the witnesses would take a large rock, turn the accused over, and throw the rock onto their chests. And if that killed them, that was it. If it didn't, then everyone else who was observing this would pick up stones and throw them at the accused until they died. Apparently, because the procedure was so gruesome and so terrifying, it was in practice not carried out. In fact, despite the presence of capital punishment in the laws of the Jews, they rarely condemned anyone to actually die. The actual practice of those convicted of a crime was to carry out a lesser sentence on them, usually some sort of whipping. Only those who defiantly stated in front of the witnesses in the tribunal, the court, that it didn't matter what happened to them, that they would continue with their sin, might they actually be sentenced to die. So apparently the records of the Jews really don't have much in the way of capital punishment actually being carried out. For first century Jews, capital punishment was a theory. The rabbinical writings had much to say on it, but was rarely, if ever, practiced. Not only that, but the Jews wouldn't be able to carry out capital punishment anyway without first securing the Romans' permission. And for adultery? Well, that wasn't going to happen. So with that kind of background in mind, we can go into the text and discuss what we read there. Verse 53 of chapter 7 reads, "They went each to his own house." And then verse 1, "But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives." This provides the setting. The one thing to note is how the people are compared to Jesus. The people have homes, but Jesus is homeless in the world he created. Verse 2, "Early in the morning he came again to the temple," this is Jesus, "all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them." So on the day of the incident, early morning, Jesus comes to the temple, a crowd is already gathered, and Jesus is sitting down teaching. And here we have the reference, the theme of light and darkness. The people went home the previous night because it got dark. But now that morning and light is appearing, Jesus is there too. And the people come to hear Jesus speak. Verse 3. "The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, 'Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say? The scribes were the teachers of the law and its interpreters. The Pharisees were those who made it their goal in life to keep all of the law and to make sure everyone else did too. So we might say that the legislative and executive branches of Jewish government came together and located a woman, just a woman, in the middle of the act of adultery. How would they have known where to find an adulteress? These are not people who are usually associated with frequenting those kinds of places. How would they have known when she would be in the very act? Jewish law states that both the man and the woman are guilty. So where was the man? If there indeed was an act of adultery, where was the man? Now, notice that the interpreters and practitioners of the law state that the law commanded them to stone such a woman. There is no mention of the man in their quoting of the law. Already, they're selectively applying their own laws for their own purposes. Not only that, but they are asking Jesus to pass a sentence they themselves would normally never carry out. In any case, they bring her and make her stand in the middle of the crowd, most likely right in front of where Jesus has been sitting, teaching. They state their selective quotation of the law and then ask Jesus for his opinion. Who was this woman? Well, honestly, no one knows. Much later, traditions infer that this could have been Mary Magdalene, but there's no evidence one way or another to know for sure. Now, what was this woman thinking and feeling? Fear, guilt, shame, anger. Perhaps asking herself, everyone else doing this gets away with it, so why me? Did this woman know she was set up? And what if she did? Well, if she did, probably even more anger, and perhaps even defiance, wanting to say, but I was framed. You know, but in that culture, a woman's word didn't hold much weight. There was no weight. No. And a criminal woman? Certainly no weight. Especially against the words of pious religious leaders. Again, this story doesn't tell us anything at all about what the woman might have been feeling or thinking. So at best, it's speculation. Verse 6 continues, "This they, the Jewish leaders who came to Jesus, said this to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground." The first part of verse 6 is a parenthetical statement by the writer. The writer is explaining the motives of the religious leaders. Now, Jesus had no civil or religious authority to render any sort of judgment in this matter. The only reason the leaders came to ask Jesus' opinion was to discredit him in front of all the people. If Jesus told them to go ahead and stone the woman, they would have the Romans arrest Jesus for breaking Roman law, thereby getting rid of Jesus that way. If Jesus told them to let the woman go because the Romans didn't allow executions, the leaders would have branded Jesus as a Roman collaborator and one who disregarded the sacred laws of Moses. And so, Jesus would have immediately lost favor with many of the Jews. And further, they would have used this as concrete evidence to prove that Jesus was a fraud. Now, they were confident, the leaders that came to Jesus were confident that this time, the trap that they had set was foolproof. What did the leaders think Jesus was going to say? Since Jesus by this time was known as a friend of sinners, my guess is that they probably thought he was going to let the woman go. Now, if Jesus did that, as I just mentioned, the problem of Jesus' influence would be taken care of. But instead of responding, Jesus remains where he is, seated, and bends down to write on the ground. What Jesus wrote has been a subject of much speculation. This is the only record that exists of Jesus ever writing anything. And what he wrote was quite temporary, in the dust on the ground. One common speculation is that he began to write the secret sins of the accusers. Another speculation is that he wrote the part of the 10th commandment that reads, "Do not covet your neighbor's wife." In doing so, Jesus would have inferred that the accusers, too, had also committed adultery, according to this interpretation Jesus gave during the Sermon on the Mount, where he says that any man who's looked upon another woman with lust has committed adultery in his heart. Yet another speculation is that Jesus wrote the command about witnesses having to throw the first stone. Or perhaps the command about false witnesses and accusers being punished with the sentence that they wanted passed on the one they had maliciously accused. It may even be that Jesus was simply doodling, trying to ignore the trap. Here were the leaders of the Jewish nation, using and abusing their laws. They were using religion to achieve their political interests. This is not a 20th and 21st century phenomenon. It's been around as long as religion and politics have been around. And you'd think everyone would wise up to it after so many millennia, but apparently we continue to fall for the same tricks. Why was Jesus trying to ignore this trap? Because he knew that if the accusers persisted, the trap that they had set would ensnare not him or the woman, but them, the accusers instead. And being a compassionate and merciful person, Jesus did not want that to happen, even to his enemies. Jesus wanted the leaders to drop the matter and go away. Well, just kind of my view of how the scene might have gone. I don't think Jesus even looked up or made eye contact with the accusers. He simply wanted them to go away. But verse 7 reads, they continue to ask him. Now, you might say they continue to pester him. They ask him, "What is your opinion? Moses said to stone such women." And Jesus finally stands up from where he's sitting and says to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." The Jewish leaders, the accusers, could not go away anymore because their egos and their political goals, the power and influence was at stake. To leave now would mean admit defeat. So they persisted. Now maybe they were beginning to feel more confident because Jesus was simply sitting there ignoring them. Maybe they thought that Jesus was trying to find some way out and Jesus couldn't find a way out. Maybe their voices were getting louder, more forceful, more arrogant, trying to force Jesus to respond. Reluctantly, Jesus stands up, faces the accusers, and makes another of his famous, or shall we say infamous, oblique statements. I can almost sense despair and sadness in Jesus' voice because the response is actually a sentence of judgment against the accusers, as we'll find out shortly. "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Just wonder what thoughts went through the woman's mind when she heard Jesus saying those words. You know, unlike us, we don't know the rest of the story. She didn't know the rest of the story yet. Was she waiting for some kind of scaffolding to be constructed? Or maybe a stone to be thrown? The phrase, "Let him who is without sin," is an interesting one. It can be understood in this straightforward manner, as in, no sin. If this were the case, it wouldn't have surprised anyone to see the accusers take their leave However, a number of commentators write that the original meaning is actually more narrow. It's more precise. They write that what it actually meant is those who are not guilty of this same type of sin. If this was indeed what Jesus intended, the accusers are now the ones with the dilemma. If they don't follow through with the stoning, they are admitting that they are also guilty of this same sin. Or, the other possibility is that they are making these accusations based on hearsay, without actually witnessing the act. But, if they do go ahead with the stoning, they are admitting that they were witnesses to the act. Notice that nowhere in this story does it say that the accusers were or were not witnesses. In doing so, if they did stone, they would have to state how so many of them came to witness this act with no one around to put a stop to it, or perhaps even have prevented the act from occurring in the first place. And by not putting a stop to the act or acting to prevent it from occurring, they were effectively condoning the act, participating in it, really. So, this is what Jesus didn't want to happen, but they forced it upon themselves. The accusers are the ones in the trap now, and they, unlike Jesus, have no way out. Whatever they do, they're either going to admit guilt to the sin of false accusation, or they're going to admit guilt to the sin of adultery through their inaction. After Jesus says that one sentence, he sits down, and once more, he bent down and wrote on the ground. And Jesus had made the point that he didn't want to make. He returns to the sitting position, bends to make more scratches in the dirt. And again, there's no record of what he wrote. There's no way to know. The Bible account immediately continues and says, "But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him." The older ones is not actually older chronologically, as in age-wise. The meaning is that the older ones were the ones who were held in more esteemed, those that commanded more respect. They were the ones who left first. The best explanation is that the ones who had more wisdom to understand that the tables had been turned on them, they exited the scene before people could start asking questions of them and figuring out what had really happened. And eventually, all of the accusers leave, and Jesus is left alone with the woman and the crowd that is still there. Of all those now left, there is still one person, Jesus, who could pass judgment on the woman. And so Jesus once again stands up, and I'm sure this time looks at the woman and asks, "Woman," which today would be more like ma'am, "where are they? Where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." Jesus shows how even though he does have the right to judge, he did not come to judge. Rather, he came to heal, restore, and to save. In past sermons, dealing with earlier passages in the Gospel of John on the subject of judgment, it was pointed out that people judge themselves. Now, that judgment is the decision that each person makes in regards to how he or she responds to Jesus in his offer of grace. God's judgment only confirms what each person has already chosen, has already judged for himself. And God chooses to honor each person's choice. However, how a person chooses to respond to God's grace has to have an effect on how a person lives. And that's what Jesus is talking about when he says to the woman, from now on, sin no more. The Apostle John, in his first letter, makes a distinction between willful sin and unintentional sin. Jesus isn't commanding the woman to never ever make another mistake, because that simply is not possible this side of heaven. What Jesus is asking the woman to do is to leave behind any patterns of willful sin. And how she chooses to respond to that act of grace will be her own judgment day. I believe one of the reasons this story was preserved is because it illustrates how Jesus contrasts his judgment with judgment typically rendered by human beings. And in doing so, I believe he was trying to clear up misconceptions that had obscured what God's judgment really is. When human beings judge, it is usually with the intent to accuse, punish, and destroy. And over the years, God's judgment has become associated with the same things. And in many people's minds today, well, the same thing is true. What Jesus showed is that God's judgment is not at all like that. God's judgment is the offer of grace through Jesus Christ. How each person responds to this offer determines their own life or death. God offers life. What do you do with it? What do I do with it? If a person decides against life, they accuse and condemn themselves. They pass sentence and punishment down on themselves. They choose to destroy themselves. In the end, God has no choice but to honor that decision. When we come across individuals that are leading lives leading to destruction, when we choose to become involved, do we come across as accusatory and condemning? Do we emphasize the destruction? Do we try to force a change? Or do we show them the life that God wants to give them? Do we emphasize the better life that can be theirs? Do we offer our own grace to them? Do we allow them to make their own fully informed decisions? In which way would you, yourself, rather be judged? Matthew 7:12. Sure you all know this. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets.